And the court in Great Lakes held that those disclaimers precluded the bringing of a case for commercial frustration and for equitable fraud. And we believe that that case controls here. In that case, the only arguments responsive on the part of Walmart is, one, that there was no express disclaimer of liability, whereas there was one in Great Lakes. And I just read to you what the disclaimer of liability was. And if that's not an express disclaimer, it says, all present and future implications of your ownership of the policies. All present and future implications. Not just tax, all present and future implications. So that's a pretty express disclaimer. And in any event, there were express disclaimers of that, plus the insurable interest issue, which they claim. I cite you to Exhibit B-25, which also has the insurable interest disclaimers. They say, well, it was carefully negotiated in Great Lakes, as if to suggest that it wasn't carefully negotiated here between Walmart, one of the largest companies in the world, and AIG. And finally, we believe that the statements and the holding by then Vice Chancellor Jacobs, now Justice Jacobs, and I want to quote this because I think it's directly applicable here, were this court to allow Great Lakes to disregard the clear terms of its disclaimers and to assert its claims of fraud, the carefully negotiated and crafted purchase agreement between the parties would similarly not be worth the paper it is written on. And we believe that if the court disregards these disclaimers in this case, the same will be true for
thank you.
Walmart. Thank you.
In police court, I'm Barry Chasnoff. I represent defendants Hartford Life and ICMG today. I'm arguing on behalf of all defendants with respect to the fault-based claims. I want to go right to the fraud claim. We had a number of reasons that the fraud claim failed in our view, but in light of Justice Ridgely's question on sham and Justice Holland's questions on the nature of the equitable fraud claim, I want to jump in my argument right to the causation argument because it comes back to the sham. There is no connection between the damages they plead and the factual background they plead. To make that make sense, I need to briefly review the links in the chain that Walmart's tried to set up on to tie the claim misrepresentations about defects to their damages. Walmart's causation claim starts with the alleged misrepresentation, what they call the undisclosed flaws and defects. And they focus on interest rates and the loading dividends and the withdrawals. They then say the IRS sued several companies because of similar defects. And then they won at the district court level. And because they won at the district court level, we had to settle. So the defects caused us to settle, caused our losses. It doesn't work, though. In its briefing, and when we talk today, counsel focuses on the district court opinions. In the four cases, in the brief, they only cite three cases, but there now is a fourth doubt. And it is true that the IRS initially attacked based upon the same sort of flaws and defects they talk about. And to some extent, the district courts found that there were factual shams in these contracts. The partial withdrawals didn't really happen, and so forth. But the courts of appeal specifically rejected that. They disallowed COLI not because of factual sham, but because of economic sham. And there's an important distinction when we're talking about here. Okay. Deductions can be disallowed either because of factual or economic sham. Factual, it didn't occur. And that's what they found as to partial withdrawals at the district court level and the loading dividends. But as I said, the courts of appeal said that they set aside those findings of factual sham. Rather, the court's appeal said that, based going back to law from 1960, but the United States Supreme Court of economic sham in the Connection case, that's if you purchase a product or you enter a program for a tax benefit, if it's a before tax loss and you're doing it to turn it into a post-tax gain, if you're only entering it for a tax profit, then it's an economic sham. And counsel started off today, again, talking about how this program was not economically viable without the tax benefits. I'm quoting from one of the briefs, their answering brief when we were down in the court below. Absent the putative tax benefits, the COLA products were not commercially viable, and Walmart would not have purchased them. That is the essence of an economic sham. Now, it is true that when the appellate courts looked at the three cases and the four cases he talked about, they said, well, the partial withdrawals may have been factual shams. We're holding that they're not. The interest rates were high. But what they said was, we don't have to look at the structure. That is, these pieces they're talking about. And quoting the Third Circuit and CM Holdings, the district court's holding that the COLI transaction as a whole lacked economic substance and thus was an economic sham is undoubtedly correct. Thus, we do not reach the issue of whether the separate components of the transaction were shams. AEP, another of these cases. In sum, the soundness of the district court's sham in fact analysis is questionable. That is, looking at these pieces they say we didn't fully disclose about. Having concluded, however, that AEP's COLI plan as a whole lacked economic substance, we declined to decide whether any particular aspects, loading dividends, interest rates, partial withdrawals, of AEP's COLI plan were factual shams.
Let me stop you for a moment because I'm having trouble following you. The complaint has allegations about how Walmart reasonably relied on representations and then lists a whole slew of representations or omissions about the underlying structure of this COLI plan. And if I understand what you're saying, well, maybe we did, but it doesn't matter because it was an economic sham?
That's correct. When they link...
Well, you'll have to expand on that for it to make sense to me.
What they're saying is, here's how we were damaged. All these things were misrepresented. And so we didn't understand it. However, as they've acknowledged, their reason for entering this was to get a tax profit, to turn a pre-tax loss into a post-tax profit, which means they knew, or they should have known, that there was a risk that it would have been set aside by the IRS, because you can't do that. Since 1960, you can't do that. And so...
Let me stop you there. Again, I need to... simplify it down to my level. You're saying that because what Walmart was looking for was a form of tax relief, if you will, that was on its face unacceptable and would have to be disallowed. The fact that you people were selling it to Walmart and saying, hey, here's this great plan. Why don't you go into it? We can forget about all that because, after all, Walmart wanted to deceive the IRS. Is that the gist of it?
What we sold and what they say we said was, we think these pieces comply with Rule 264. But as Mr. Jordan pointed out, there's a lot of flexibility in how you use the pieces. You're warned of that. And the way you choose to use those pieces can get this disallowed. And Walmart has said in its pleadings, we intended all along to use the pieces to turn a pre-tax loss into a post-tax gain.
Which is something your people knew, right? I mean, everybody was talking the same language when you were putting this together, weren't you?
Although it's not in the complaint, we're going outside the complaint, I suspect that people were aware that Walmart or others might try to use it that way. But that was the reason for the warning that you need to decide how you're going to use it and work with tax advisors. COLI still exists and is still used in perfectly acceptable ways where these components, not all COLI has been set aside. It's the way it was used here that it was set aside. And so
but,
these are.
But again, I very well may be oversimplifying here, but if you've got a large company that wants to minimize its taxes, and you've got some professionals in the insurance industry who say, well, here's something that works, or here's something that we're promoting, we're suggesting you do, and you know, you can't deny that somehow or another, I mean, Walmart didn't have to coerce you to come up with these COLI plans to sell them. So you seem to be saying at this point that, well, Walmart knew that we were both entering into a fraudulent transaction. I mean, that's almost what it sounds like, that, well, you knew what Walmart wanted. Walmart knew what it wanted. You provided them something, but you told them, you know, if anybody ever figures this out, it's all going to go down the drain.
I think that goes beyond the reality of what's pled and what Mr. Jordan was talking about. As I said, there are a number of components. It can be used in different ways. But if you go to your advisors, if you use it in the wrong way, the IRS can disallow it. And so there's a recognized risk, and that risk was not shifted. The risk was on Walmart because they were the ones taking the deductions. The policies that Hartford sold and that AIG sold said, here's what we will do. You pay us X dollars, and if someone dies, we pay them Y. Traditional life insurance. We issued $50,000. There were ways to use them, variable interest rates. There were partial withdrawals. You can take loans. But if you do it the wrong way, it's subject to the IRS saying no, and okay. That's the risk you take.
Okay. If I read some portions of the complaint correctly, Walmart at least alleges that, A, it didn't know a lot of information about some of the accounting aspects and the loading of dividends and what have you, which presumably had some impact on why these things ultimately didn't pass muster, and that, more importantly, that Walmart was relying on the defendants and would not have entered into these agreements if it had known the truth. Now, Walmart may never be able to prove those allegations, but aren't they enough to state a claim?
Well, a couple quick points on that. One, what they said they didn't know were two things. One, about the interest rates being outside the NAIC, National Association of Insurance Commissioners, suggested guidelines. Or suggested guidelines that weren't mandatory, but more importantly, it's a public document. So they're on notice of what the NAIC recommends for interest rates and insurance policies. And they don't say that they didn't know how much they were paying. They were paying Moody's BAA, a high rate. They knew that. And the NAIC guidelines were public knowledge. The other thing they say they knew about were the partial withdrawals and the loading dividends, which they knew how they were working, and they say in their complaint, we knew that using them were an integral part of making this thing economically viable and to get the tax benefits that we wanted. They knew that. What they're saying is we didn't know that there were some insurance commissioners who had disapproved or not approved it. They don't say, first of all, it's that there was any discussion that anyone said to them, it's been approved in all 50 states and no one raised a question. It was approved in the states where they bought it. It's public record, over 40 states approved it. A few states raised questions. And they've seized on that to say, well, had we known that a couple of insurance commissioners had raised some questions about it, then we wouldn't have bought it. But the fact is, they don't allege that they ever asked that question.
But the thing is, you just said, but the fact is, and I know you were just a manner of speaking, but my point is, or my question is, all of this information that you're giving me that's helping to clarify what's going on here Isn't that part of what goes on in a trial?
Well, I should have more precisely said they don't allege that they ask us about who had approved it and who had not approved it. There's no allegation that we ever talked about it. All they say is somebody that raised questions about it. There's no allegation that of a partial discussion of what happened.
Well, excuse me one second. What about the insurance commissioner in Connecticut that started raising a lot of questions with what your company was doing? When was that? While these policies were still being issued or before the whole program began or when?
I believe those questions were after these particular policies have been issued, but I'm standing here today, I'm not.
Because that is alleged in the complaint, and that is alleged that you didn't mention it to them.
Correct. But, once again, it,
isn't your home office in Connecticut?
Hartford's home office is in Connecticut. And questions were raised, policies never disallowed, policies ultimately approved. Of course, that's going outside the complaint. But what they say is some commissioner in Connecticut raised a question. Policies, well, it is public record that the policies were approved in Connecticut. But they never, when someone buys insurance and say we want it issued out of that state, it has to be approved in that state. It was approved in the state. And there's no allegation they ever said, aha, but in your home state, are they questioning any aspect of it? And so it's not, we haven't talked about the fiduciary duty, but I mean, I think it's clear insurance company doesn't have a fiduciary duty. We've cited the cases that say just you can apply this in every case. Often the insurance salesman is more sophisticated than the insurance purchaser, and so you could always create a fiduciary duty if you say, well, they knew more than we did. Walmart was sophisticated, we were sophisticated, and the transaction occurred.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Roger Cox on behalf of the brokers, NBG and Marsh, principally talking about the fiduciary duty and negligence counts in the complaint. The crux of the case from the broker's point of view is there was a contractual relationship between Walmart and the brokers, and the alleged omissions that Walmart is complaining about was beyond the scope of the broker's engagement. Under the appellate standard, neither inferences nor conclusions of fact unsupported by allegations of specific facts are accepted as true. The facts alleged in the complaint are what set the parameters of what the contractual relationship was between the brokers and Walmart. In paragraph 6 of the complaint, Walmart alleges that defendants held themselves out as having negotiating power and expertise, service and administration, long-term relationships with insurers, and creativity in addressing tax law change. And I think we've set out in the supplemental briefing that tax law change meant legislative change, not applying law that previously existed to future facts. In paragraph 29, Walmart alleges that it assigned to the brokers the following tasks: overseeing design and structure, preparing questions and soliciting proposals, selecting insurers, negotiating terms and conditions. In paragraph 33, Walmart alleges what the brokers did: prepared and distributed a request for proposal, arranged for presentations, and provided Walmart with evaluation and recommendation. There is no allegation in the complaint that the brokers ever agreed to give Walmart complicated tax and legal advice relating to COLI plans. In fact, count 4, the contract count, in paragraph 99, simply alleges a breach of good faith and fair dealing. It points to Walmart points to no specific contractual undertaking breached by the brokers. Walmart alleges not that the brokers did something wrong or said something wrong, but they failed to disclose material information which they knew or should have known. It doesn't say which it is. It could be either. Generally, at its most extreme, Walmart alleges that the brokers failed to advise Walmart as to the full range and magnitude of tax-related risks regarding COLI plans generally, and these COLI specifically, and the full range and magnitude of uninsurable risks. The brokers never agreed to provide that service to Walmart. More specifically, in the items listed in the letter from the court for supplemental briefing, Walmart points to internal policy features which it alleges deviated from standard policies regarding withdrawals from cash values, loading charges, dividends, interest rate calculations. No one is alleging that these policies were illegal. They just deviated from standard. They were unusual policies. The significance of what Walmart is complaining about takes tax and legal expertise to understand, which the brokers can't be expected to have and never agreed to provide. It wasn't part of their assignment. Moreover, to the extent that Walmart points to such incidents as legal advice that one or more insurers may have received, or discussions internally, or discussions with an insurance department of a state, knew or should have known under Court of Chancery law is not an adequate allegation that the brokers actually knew these internal facts that Walmart's complaining about. And knowledge of an omitted fact is required, even of a fiduciary, to create an obligation of disclosure. Under the Restatement of Torts Second, Section 551, Sub 2, which has been relied upon by this court. Walmart has two theories for why there is a fiduciary duty of the brokers. The first theory is that there was a fiduciary duty by reason of an agency relationship. There was no agency relationship. This court in Heller v. Kiernan affirmed Vice Chancellor Lamb's decision regarding a real estate broker who did not have power to act, buy property on behalf of the customer. Under the restatement, an agent is required, in order to be an agent, has to have the power to act on behalf of the principal. An agent in Section 12 of the restatement is one who holds a power to alter the legal relations between the principal and third persons. There is no allegation that the brokers were empowered to buy COLI policies on Walmart's behalf. Therefore, it could not have been an agent. The specific facts that Walmart relies upon are essentially no more than an assertion of the broker's expertise. That expertise did not include giving complicated tax and legal advice. It included the items that were recited before about the scope of the engagement. It would be unreasonable for Walmart to expect tax or legal advice from insurance brokers. Just taking the Dow Chemical case alone, the trial judge spent 25 pages of very complicated, dense legal reasoning to analyze the merits of the COLI in that case in terms of tax deductions. That judge was reversed in the Court of Appeals by 2-1 vote. So, in a sense, two sophisticated federal judges held that COLI was compliant with the Internal Revenue Code, and two held that it was not. How can an insurance broker engage in that kind of analysis? In the Mayo case cited by the parties, dealing with insurable interest, the federal trial judge in Texas spent 35 pages analyzing the conflicts of law issues as to what law applies to decide which state's insurable interest law applies. Insurance brokers cannot be expected to delve into that kind of complicated legal analysis. The Court of Chancery properly held that conclusory allegations do not constitute a fiduciary relation. The relationship was contractual, as is alleged in the complaint. There was no joint undertaking. There was no allegation of domination or control. And there was no allegation of self-dealing. So therefore, there could be no fiduciary relationship among the parties. The negligence count must fall for essentially the same reasons. The allegation of negligence in count 5 in paragraph 106 is that simply as general as this: the brokers failed to exercise the requisite skill and diligence and meet duties of good faith, disclosure, and professionalism. Again, the duties undertaken by the brokers were no broader than those assigned and did not include complicated tax and legal advice. In Sinex v. Wallace, Judge Hurley, he said, assumptions do not create either an expanded duty of care or a breach of an ordinary duty of care. Moreover, in this case, there is no allegation in the complaint anywhere to be found about a payment by Walmart to the brokers for tax or legal advice over and above the premiums paid, which is the Sinex test for an expanded duty. In paragraph 28 of the complaint, Walmart alleges generically that brokers can receive fees from policyholders. It nowhere alleges that the brokers received fees from Walmart for tax and legal advice. The brokers did the things that Walmart claims were incumbent upon a typical broker to do, Walmart quoting Amger a second. The brokers selected the insurers, ascertained they were of good credit and standing, obtained as good terms as were reasonably possible, and the brokers did not supply any false information. Walmart does not contend otherwise. Instead, it contends the brokers did not warn it of potential tax and uninsurable risks, tasks the brokers were unsuited to perform, were not requested to perform, and did not agree to perform. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me just quickly address the broker issues. And Justice Berger, thank you for your questions. I feel like I could hug you on the economic sham doctrine. If there was an economic sham and everybody knew about it, then it ought to have been disclosed, and it wasn't. There's not a single document that I've seen, and nothing that any of the defendants have suggested would demonstrate that they told Walmart that these programs would fall within the NETCH test and would be disallowed. So if we knew it, they should have known it. It was their business, not ours. What did the brokers tell us they were going to do? In paragraph 6 of our complaint, this is a quote from Marsha McLennan's proposal to us. Marsha McLennan views its role as the major negotiator with the insurance carriers on Walmart's behalf. Skip down. The financial projections and legal assurances will ultimately be negotiated more fully prior to Walmart's implementing the purchase. We bring four measures of value added to Walmart as your COLI broker: negotiating power in the insurance business, commitment of our organization, existing long-term relationship with the recommended carriers since their entry in the COLI market, and the fourth one, creativity in helping Walmart address all issues when tax laws change. So they did walk down the path of providing advice and creativity in dealing with tax law changes. Once you walk down the path of providing legal and tax advice, there's an obligation to do it fully, fairly, and I believe, and we've alleged, that they had information that was material to these transactions that was not disclosed. Paragraph 40 of our complaint, we have letters from Mr. Nystrom of Marsha McLennan to Walmart saying that if the plans fail in the early years, there will be a refund as if the policies had not been issued. Second, from Mr. Nystrom to Walmart, the worst case scenario, if there is a tax law change, is a $237,000 loss. Now, that was explicitly stated to us by these brokers. Now, I don't know if that's an opinion. I don't know if it, but it sure sounds like a representation of fact to me.
And a why isn't that an opinion?
Because when you're in the business of COLI and you make representations about how the COLI programs apply and what the downside risks are, and you're an expert in that business, what might be an opinion from a layperson's standpoint is a representation of fact from an expert, and it's something that Walmart was entitled to rely on. And that's the distinction. When you're an expert in an area and you provide assurances in your area of expertise to one who is not, then what may ordinarily be an opinion, Your Honor, becomes a representation of fact, because that is the business that they're in. They expect you to rely on it, and it's reasonable for you to rely on people with expertise. That's why I believe that representation is a representation of fact.
And now, Mr. Gordon,
yes, Your Honor.
You indicated that you went and got the best advice you could, but doesn't your complaint also indicate that you had other lawyers and other accountants and tax advisors?
No, our complaint doesn't say that. Vice Chancellor Lamb asked me at the last argument, did Walmart have any other experts look at this, and I said, yes, we had internal people in our tax department that were involved in reviewing the transaction. And we had Mr. Emmerich, who's the head of HR, human resources at Walmart, who was the principal person who looked into these issues. But they did not have the expertise or the capability to uncover the flaws in the programs that the carriers were well aware of because of the state of New York, the state of Washington, the state of Connecticut.
But we do have this letter that's incorporated by reference in your complaint that says you, Walmart, have to go get your own tax advice.
What it says is that it's a representation to AIG, one carrier, that we're not relying on their experts or brokers, but we're relying on our experts and brokers. Well, our experts and brokers are sitting at this table, or their lawyers are sitting at this table. Those are the people we relied on for that advice. The other issue is that letter of understanding attaches illustrations to it about how the program would apply. Those illustrations state unqualifiedly that these illustrations are accurate for a period of 3 months. So that representation there was that these comply with the law as it exists today, and they would comply for 3 months. The ellipsis in the letters that one of the lawyers quoted to the court about the trustee may make changes in the plan that could affect the viability. The reason that was ellipses out is that it's irrelevant, because what it says is that if there is something that you do to change the plan after you buy it, we're not responsible for that because you will have control at that point. Well, there's no allegation or claim that we changed the plan. The IRS came in and said this plan was flawed from the outset when it was sold, and the reasons it was flawed was because of interest rate deviations, accounting deviations, surplus dividend deviations, excessive loading charges that have been challenged by not just the regulators but by their own lawyers and by their own actuarials. Mr. Van Eaton, Steptoe and Johnson, a very fine law firm, had rendered an opinion saying this is very questionable. None of that was disclosed. Whether it should have been is a question of fact. It should not be determined as a matter of law that those problems, and it's not just risks. I mean, these are flaws in the program. Those flaws should have been disclosed. I mean, if I sell you a car and it's got bad brakes, you know, does that? Yeah, that increases the risk of an accident, and I have an obligation to tell you about it. But also, I have an obligation to tell you you have flawed brakes. It's both a problem with the program that increased the risk that the program wouldn't do what it was intended to do. So I hesitate to characterize this as simply a risk allocation exercise, because I think that there was much more behind these. There were more problems, more flaws in these programs than were disclosed, and that those flaws ultimately resulted in them being determined to be economic or factual shams. On the Great Lakes case, I mean, if you read the disclaimers in Great Lakes, they're very broad. We take the buyers has no liability, assumes no liability. Including fitness for a particular purpose of the transaction. Here, clearly, this product wasn't fit for its intended purpose, and there was no disclaimer of that. You know, the disclaimers in Great Lakes were negotiated heavily. The court found that. This disclaimer that AIG was it was drafted by them and was given to us at the last minute, within days after they had sent letters to us representing that this does that the policies or the COLI plans comply with Section 7702 and Section 264. The disclaimer, at best, in my view, applies solely to we are not going to hold you responsible for the performance of this program and the tax benefits that going forward. But I certainly have never, and Walmart certainly never considered it a release of all claims for failing to disclose material problems in the plans. Whether it ultimately is construed in that manner, it should be done based on a full record and the facts, and putting the context and the contracts, all of the contracts, in place and in context and viewed fully, not just in excerpted portions like that we have here in the complaint. And my only reference to the letter of understanding of the complaint is basically criticizing the carriers for not telling us that the LOU was never submitted to insurance regulators for approval. Their master plan COLI policy was. That was submitted to insurance regulators, reviewed and approved, and it was a standard policy in many states. As far as I know, the letter of understanding, which they say forms a part of the policy, was not. It calls into question its entire enforceability. And again, at best, it applies to AIG. It certainly doesn't apply to the other defendants, and not to the brokers, because those were the experts and consultants that Walmart was relying on and represented in that letter of understanding. Your Honor, I've got 30 seconds. Are there any questions that I can answer that cause you grief?
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Horton, Mr. Jordan, Mr. Chasnoff, Mr. Cox. We appreciate your arguments. We will take this matter under advisement, and we will adjourn.